I am going to ask the biggest of the big questions. I did a couple of television series with Paul Davies on the big questions, a couple of books as well, but they weren't big enough. There's a bigger question that Paul didn't tackle. It's such a big question that we've had it set to music. Would you be kind enough, Maestro?
Just you.
Well, does it? We're going to establish this. Did you notice they were singing with German accents? Where the hell did you find that, Paul? Anyway, we're going to establish whether or not chewing gum does lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight. We're going to look at the history of chewing gum. It's one of the things I like about doing this program. I learn all sorts of terrific stuff. We did a program once on the history of the zipper, for example, which turns out to have played a not inconsequential role in sexual liberation. And then we did another program on the dildo, and it turns out that the dildo, or if you prefer the dildo-t, if you're moralistic, was the very first appliance that was ever electrified. And it was electrified because mass masturbation was taking place. Doctors were bringing women to climax all over the world because it lowered their nervous tension. See, you only get this good stuff on this program. Tonight, the history of chewing. It's the one thing that much of the world's populace shares in a united and dedicated fashion, without political boundaries, without social mores, and costs next to nothing. And chewy has a fascinating history, as my next guest will attest. Michael Redcliffe is, of all things, a professor of geography at King's College London. He's a leading scholar in ecology, social theory, and in his spare time, he writes and edits books, and they're the sort of books that we've always loved on this program. Little pieces of historical revelation. Now, his latest book, it's about chewing gum, is entitled, and this will astonish you, it's an abstruse and strange title, it's called Chewing Gum, The Fortunes of Taste. And Michael joins me now in our London studio. Michael,
hi.
How are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
Now take your chewy out, won't you? But don't stick it under the table.
I won't, no.
Michael, I read in the introduction of chewing gum to the US has a rather odd story. Would you tell us what it is?
Well, it is a strange and wonderful story, really, because what happened was that a former Mexican president called Santa Anna met up with a rather weird and eccentric man called Thomas Adams, who became the Thomas Adams of chewing gum fame, on Staten Island, New York, in 1869. And Adams managed to sell a big lump of raw chewing gum, of chicle, to Santa Anna managed to sell it to Adams. So that was really the birth of chewing gum as we know it, I suppose, we knew it in the 20th century.
Is this a bit like St. Joan hearing her voices, was it, when Adams was given this this precious artifact?
Well, Adams had been trying to make rubber tires, and he thought at first he could use this great dollop, a huge great mound of dirty, sticky gum on the floor. He thought he could use it to make some tires. But then the story goes, it may be apocryphal, but he saw a little girl come into a drugstore, a corner drugstore in New York, and ask for some chewing gum. And the chewing gum she wanted, of course, was spruce-based gum, you know, based on the resin from the spruce tree. And he thought, well, maybe I can turn my mound of rubbish into something useful. And so he went into production, he started making it, and found he could add flavors and so on, and it became quite successful. But of course, once he was successful, everybody else wanted to do it as well.
I'm suddenly remembering one of the most unpleasant programs I've ever been involved in, or the most tragic stories, and that, of course, involves what happened in the Belgian Congo, with millions dying because they were having to provide rubber for the bicycle industries of the world.
Yes.
It's a pity that this chewing gum didn't provide a substitute. Anyway, but as you point out, chewing gum was already had a sort of a market share in the US through various resins.
Yes, that's right. What made chicle better than them? First of all, of course, a lot of those resins were disappearing. I mean, the trees weren't enough trees around. But what made chicle particularly good is it had all the qualities that a good gum should have. and it helped to refresh the mouth, and you know, it was, and you could add flavors to it. So it was something of an innovation. But I should say to you, you know, it wasn't so unlike your rubber tappers in the Congo, because the people who tapped the gum, who tapped the chicle in Mexico and Yucatan, they lived under terrible conditions. I mean,
they paid a very heavy price.
They paid a very heavy price, and at one point there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of these people. So it was a pretty raw life living out in the tropical forests, you know, getting up these trees into the canopy, and obviously all the injuries and the diseases and that they were exposed to, and they were exploited appallingly. I mean, they weren't paid until the end of the season, and they had a very hard time indeed.
But it also helped to, well, it detonated quite a lot of political protest, didn't it?
It did. Yes, it did. Well, first of all, there were so many parts. I wanted to call my book originally The Chewing Gum Wars, but now it's called Chewing Gum, The Fortunes of Taste, because it's all about some people making fortunes out of gum, and it's obviously about taste. But, you know, at one point, the people who were Mayan Indians, indigenous people in the Yucatan, who were, you know, very largely responsible for tapping the gum, they were using the proceeds of this to fund their own army, to pay for armaments, to fight off the Mexican state. So they were actually selling gum to Wrigley's, and Wrigley's, or through intermediaries, to companies like Wrigley's, and they were able, with the proceeds, to actually build up some, to help their armed resistance, because they were trying to break away from the Mexican government. So it's a story all the way through for the last century and a bit about war, and chewing is connected with war, believe it or not.
It's one of the very few vices that I was never attracted to. I could never quite see the point of chewing. Why do people... I mean, in some ways, it seems the most useless of all products.
Well, that's one of the things that intrigued me. I mean, one of the things that intrigued me, why I wanted to write this book, you know, and write a book that wasn't an academic tome, was that, you know, here is something which is, in a sense, worthless, but which can be branded and sold and advertised. In a sense, it was one of the first products. It was the first product, for example, to be sold from a vending machine. And it can be advertised as something very personal and very intimate in a way. And that tradition has continued, because now we have medicated gums and gums for all kinds of purposes. I don't personally chew much gum, but I'm not sure I'm the best example. Plenty of my students do. I look at them sometimes in the lecture theatre, and I just see hundreds of people chewing gum. So I'm hoping that some of them will buy my book anyway.
Your book reminds me, in a sense, of the Cornflake Wars in Battle Creek. Now, that was a phenomenon, of course, of one particular religious group, the Adventists, but you had this great battles between, say, the Kellogg brothers and others. But you document similar battles between the would-be chewy tycoons.
That's right. Well, there were a number of people who came into the market, and obviously what they needed to do was to develop something that was special, that looked at, marked their own gums out from others. And there were all kinds of devices for this, you know, and they sent young, attractive girls out into the streets to give away samples, and they gave the gum funny names, and there were all kinds of different devices. But the fortunes that were made, and I think in 1920, the sales from chewing gum were worth $100 million in the U.S., and that
is that in adjusted terms or in,
that was the figure at the time, so it's very, very high.
Heavens above, that's
yes,
it's ginormous,
a major industry.
Yeah.
Yes,
and as you point out, new rituals, new traditions, everyday occurrences, rhythms develop around chewing gum.
That's right. I mean, if you think, stand back and think about it, the very ordinariness of it, the fact that you can carry it anywhere, you can chew while you're working. You know, I argue in the book that it's connected with, you know, with shift work and the kind of work that was going on in the kind of industrial, the new industrial urban centers, particularly in the States on the eastern seaboard. You know, this was something that, and of course then later during the Second World War in the ration, because chewing gum traveled well. You know, you could take it with you into the theaters of conflict. It went in the C ration and the K ration, which the American forces had. So it was quite an important kind of accoutrement. It was something they looked for in their pack. All the evidence is that chewing gum was one of the most popular thing, along with cigarettes, that were in the pack. And so it had, and the rituals around it, I mean, very often I think, you know, were peculiar to particular groups. So you have rituals for children and rituals for people, you know, that they the sharing of chewing gum. You go right back to Tom Sawyer.
Yes, because he shares his spruce gum, doesn't he, with Becky Thatcher.
That's it, absolutely. And I can't pretend that I've managed to discover all the rituals associated with chewing gum. But I think the question, this issue of why something that has no value could be sold so successfully, really on the back of all its associations, the American dream of...
it becomes the iconic product in the sense it's as much a part of America or more a part of America than even Marlboro, another case of dazzlingly successful global marketing.
That's it, exactly, yes. And, we don't know it, we don't recognize an iconic product, I suppose, until we've got one, as it were. And this is one of the interesting things that I was amazed that nobody had really... There are a couple of books for kids, but there's no serious treatment of the history of chewing gum. So it was one of the things that attracted me to it.
I think a little bit of guilt attaches to it, because the one thing I remember from school, Michael, is that it was seen... To be seen chewing gum was a form of demonic possession. And class teacher and the headmaster. I mean, I was actually... Yeah. I can remember kids being sent out of the room for chewing gum. Yeah. Yeah. And so, was there a backlash? Was there a moralistic attitude to chewing gum, as we would see later on with marijuana?
Mm. Well, there was at the time. I mean, first of all, of course, Wrigley's were manufacturing and selling gum in Asia, particularly before the last war. So in China and Japan and so on, and there were lots of campaigns there suggesting that nobody should chew it. So it wasn't confined to the United States, the idea that, this was bad for you, this is going to corrupt you. But as you say, all over the world, you find the idea. And of course, the more you make something into a product that nobody's supposed to have, the more that kids are going to want it in a way. So it becomes cool to chew gum. And you can be a celebrity, celebrities chew gum. So that, this builds a kind of relationship.
Well,
with
not only chew it, you could do tricks with it, couldn't you?
You could do tricks with bubble gum.
You could stretch. What's the distinction? What's the distinction between chewy and bubble?
Well, the distinction is the idea. The chicle, the stuff that comes from the trees in the Yucatan forest, which made up natural chewing gum, which was most chewing gum until 1950, about 1950 in the Korean War. Obviously, that's a natural product. Bubble gum, you can't blow bubbles from chicle. So although there'd been experiments at making synthetic gums, back in the 1920s, by the 1930s, various people had perfected ways of making bubbles that you could blow. I mean, the idea, is kind of bizarre, and yet it's part of everyday life, isn't it? But you needed a synthetic gum to do that. So bubble gum has a kind of spin-off history, really.
That'll be the sequel, won't it? You'll be able to...
Yeah, I hope it... Well, if this does well, I think I hope it will, yes.
Yes. I can remember when Ralph Nader first visited Australia, he made the point that Coca-Cola had a pipeline, and this is a quote, had a pipeline to the gullets of the third world.
Yeah.
And he said, what a tragedy that Coke didn't put nutrition into Coca-Cola. Now, I'm wondering, did anyone ever attempt to assuage... Or to neutralise the critics of bubble gum by trying to make it nutritious? You could flavour it, you could put anything into it. Why not put vitamins into it?
Well, that's something I don't have a ready answer to. I think today some people are buying it, real chicle, on the web because it's a natural product and it comes from the forest in the belief that it's good for them. And there is a feeling that this is something that... like a lot of other organic, natural products, will be good for us. So to some extent, that's arrived. And you can, I think, there are one or two companies that do sell on the web that you can get. But there are medicated gums now, aren't there? There are gums, where they add medication to it. But
I don't know. I'm astonished to learn this.
Yeah.
I'm chewing the fat here with Michael Redcliffe from King's College London, who's the author of a book, enchantingly entitled Chewing Gum. Let's talk about the relationship between Mexico and the US, because chewing gum starts to provoke some interesting situations.
That's right. Well, the history is so much bound up with that relationship. As I say, going back to Santa Anna, who'd been a president of Mexico, who was the person who's usually credited with having sold the idea to Thomas Adams, one of the first producers. But from then onwards, the relationship's a close one. I mean, the major importers, the manufacturers, are American companies. There's manufacturing in Mexico too, and indeed, of course, other countries in the world. But the main companies are particularly Wrigley's, American-based. And so, you know, they have to get that, while they're dependent on organic natural gum, then they have to get their supplies from the forest producers. And at different stages in the story, when chewing gum became quite important strategically, I mean, the best example, I guess, is after the U.S. entered the war, and Wrigley's put out a wrapper which said, with the spearmint, Wrigley's spearmint chewing gum, with a byline saying, "We will be back," because they withdrew Wrigley's spearmint during the war so that the troops had it, you see. So they introduced something called Orbit, which the name still runs. But there was always a need to get to actually source this gum. So, in fact, representatives of the Chicle, the chewing gum cooperatives, and the workers and so on, were flown to the United States to negotiate so that supplies could be guaranteed and that they could guarantee or seek better prices for what they were getting. It was definitely a strategically important product, although that sounds amazing, after the U.S. went into the Second World War.
Of course, we've got to remind the listener that America was going through a phase where a whole lot of new addictions and fads were taking over. I mentioned the breakfast cereal phenomenon, but we had homeopathy, we had chiropractic, electric shock treatment, mineral water cures, vegetarianism, temperance. It was a very creative time, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it's in a very interesting period. I find that the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, you know, what America's doing in a sense is finding its own mass popular culture. And of course, subsequently, it's influenced all of us all over the world. And talking about the fads, one that maybe the listeners might be interested in was a guy called Horace Fletcher.
I want you to talk about the great masticator.
Well, I think anybody called the great masticator is worth having a few words about. This guy really believed that if you chewed your food very deliberately and carefully and sort of painstakingly, really, because he took ages and ages to chew, that this was much better for your digestion. It probably did mean you ate rather less, so in some ways he may have been right. But he became himself, this became a big fad, what was called Fletcherizing, rather. And he was examined by doctors, eminent doctors in Yale, and was said to be a marvelous figure of health. And he argued that this was because of the way he chewed. So chewing in itself, you know, became quite an obsession. And he had some very powerful, influential friends. He wasn't regarded, I think, in that period just as a lunatic. I think he was seen as one of many people with a good idea.
Now, I'm going to read a sentence of your book because it's a pretty heavy sentence and I want you to justify it. Here we go. The history of chewing gum provides evidence of the significance of spatial relations, particularly the way that spatial scales are linked to the evolution of capitalist economic relations.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying, you know, is that the people who chewed gum, particularly in the United States and today, for that matter, people aren't aware of where it's sourced from, where it comes from. And the connections, the commercial connections that developed across thousands of miles. I mean, the Yucatan Peninsula is that big bit that goes out into the Caribbean. It's fairly remote, even from Mexico City. So in a sense, something very ordinary, very much a part of everyday life, has a history bound up with the way that the forest was cleared. So in fact, to get at these trees started a process which ended in the clearing of much, not all, but much of the forest in the Yucatan Peninsula. And the relationships that it set up, it meant that entrepreneurs came in as contractors, and they contracted men to do to go up the trees and get the resin. And, you know, also obviously had to supply them, so there was a lot of activity, economic activity around the supplies and the mules and so on, and then sell the product to be reprocessed and have things added to it.
So it is a transformational product, isn't it? Everything from the depletion of mahogany and cedar stands to the invention of vending machines in railway stations in New York.
Yeah. And of course, those people I was interested first, because I started when I was stopping at a petrol gas station, you know, to get some petrol in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. People talked about chicle, and some of them had, you know, local produced chicle, and it was their history, and it wasn't the history I'd seen written up at all. You know, it was there are some academic articles about it, but relatively few. And so it seemed to me this was the powerhouse, as it were, of the great American habit, the great American invention, and chewing gum is associated with so many other things.
I would have thought it's making a bit of a comeback, given that smoking is now pretty much verboten. Mm. Are people chewing as a substitute for cigarettes?
I think they are, yeah. I think they are. One of my daughters is giving up smoking, and she's chewing some gum instead. I think it's become and also much more acceptable. You know, I think, as you were suggesting earlier, that quite often it was an act of some, you know, it's rebellion in public, in a schoolroom or a classroom. It was could be quite rebellious. But now chewing is often seen as a safe option, I think, and maybe it is making a comeback in that way.
What sort of shape is the Yucatan Peninsula in now, Michael?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things it's doing, I mean, obviously much of the forest, not all of it, but a lot of the forest had been taken out, partly as a consequence of chewing gum with chicle, and settled with ranchers, and the coast has been turned over in a huge way, of course, to tourism. Cancun, Cozumel, Isla Mujeres, all these places, Tulum, on the Mexican Caribbean coast, were all important in the history of chewing gum, and now they're there with, you know, all sorts of every type of tourism, really, mass tourism, ecotourism. It's all there. So in a sense, the peninsula is very much a part of a new global market. So from having been the source of one of the big products of the 20th century, it's now become part of another kind of consumption, you know, the consumption of of resorts and recreational places, and people go there to get the sun, but also to see the Mayan ruins and things.
Michael, so is chewing gum still dominated by Wrigley's? Is it an oligopoly of a couple of famous marketers?
It's well, if you look at gross sales internationally, that's true. If you looked at individual countries like Greece and Turkey and so on, have lots of small manufacturers. So there is room in lots of parts of the world for lots of smaller manufacturers, but Wrigley's are very much the big player. And I went to the Wrigley's building in Chicago. It was a bit like a mission. I had to get there. And this was a famous building anyway, because it was a wonderful kind of 1920s, 30s modernist building. And I was a bit disappointed to find that most of it is let. It's all let as office space now. They used to have, I think, a little museum there, but there isn't a great deal now. There's a small office with some. They'll give you some gum samples, but it's still the Wrigley's building. And of course, Wrigley's, that's the other side of the story, influenced the development of Chicago and other areas, and you know, the baseball teams and so on. So it's got quite a rich history there.
Thank you very much, Michael. Michael Redcliffe, who's Professor of Geography at King's College London, the only international authority on chewing gum. Chewing Gum, The Fortune of Taste, published by Routledge. A pleasure and a privilege. Good on you.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great.
On our next, we'll be talking to Bruce Shapiro, and we'll look at our intelligence services. The Flood Report, which looked at our agencies, came out in July to much muttering in the community. So we will discuss how effective the report was and whether our intelligence is any good. Are our intelligence failures as common as our politicians would have us believe? Now, let's all sort of start chewing away, and while we're doing that, we'll stick around, very, very amusing, for the news, followed by The Planet. See you later. Does your chewing gum a little bit flavour on the bedpost overnight? If your mother say don't chew it, do you swallow it in spite? Can you pitch it on your tonsils? Can you heave it left and right? Does your chewing gum a little bit flavour on the bedpost overnight? He comes a flushing bride, the groomy by her side. Up to the altar, he's steady as Gibraltar. The groom has got the ring. It's such a pretty thing, but as it slips it on the fingers, that shame begin to sing.
All together.
Does your chewing gum lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight? If your mother say you're chewing, do you swallow in its bite?
Can you catch it on your tonsils? Can you hear it left or right? That's a trick of the loser's flavor. All the best must know when I.
Now the nation rises one to center on its own. Up to the White House, the nation only cried out to point their discontent on to the president. Upon their burning question, what has left this continent?
If tins missing to be made of tin,
what do they make for Dunsaroff?
Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the red post overnight? If your mother say don't chew it, do you swallow it in fine? Can you catch it on your tongue? Can you heave it left or right? Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the red post overnight? On the red post overnight.
I'm going to want you all to die.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night.
On the red post.
Dime.
You're singing on the course, Marty. I ain't got the time.
On the red post.